So I'm just going to read from the first chapter of the novel. This opens with an epigraph from a fictional dictionary called Lady Ada's Lexicon. Sherpa, a person who acts as a paid guide in a massive multiplayer online role-playing game. Sherpas provide their clients with playable characters, equipment, and skilled teammates, allowing them to experience high-level game content that would otherwise require hundreds of hours to reach. Sherpas typically act as freelancers, unaffiliated with the companies whose game worlds they operate in. Like gold buying and other pay-to-win strategies, the use of Sherpas is regarded by many players as a form of cheating. Game companies vary in their attitude towards the practice, with some tolerating Sherpas' existence, while others, notably Tempest, makers of the popular Call to Wizardry, classify Sherpa activity as a violation of the end-user license agreement and a bannable offense. The client is an idiot. His name is Brad Strong, and in real life he works as a commodities trader at one of those big Wall Street banks that's always implicated but never held accountable whenever the economy crashes. According to his social media accounts, Brad is a graduate of the Wharton School of Finance. He owns a 1,900-square-foot duplex in Soho and drives a Jaguar XP. He rock climbs and scuba dives and is a student of Krav Maga, the martial art practiced by Israeli commandos. Philosophically, he considers himself a libertarian, but he votes Republican because let's be serious. He's a fan of the Three Stooges and early Chuck Palahniuk. He hates fat chicks, libtards, and people who won't shut up about their kids. Tonight, Brad is paying me and my associates at Sherpa Incorporated a substantial fee. Substantial to us, trivial to him, to take him adventuring in the realms of Asgarth and Tempest's Call to Wizardry. Like the majority of clients, he has opted for a DPS character, a 200th level elf samurai. Brad thought about going with an orc ninja instead, but decided he'd rather not lurk in the shadows like a pussy. He wants to charge the monsters head-on and crack some skulls. I'm tanking, as a warrior troll named Blockhead of Moria. My job is to hold aggro, get the monsters to concentrate their attacks on me and my plate mail of invulnerability, while the DPS characters, Brad and my colleagues Jolene and Anya, do their damage per second thing, and Ray, running heals as a gnome cleric, stanches any bleeding that my armor can't prevent. It's a balancing act. The DPS need to finish off the monsters before the healer runs out of mana and everybody dies. But if they do too much damage too quickly, they'll steal aggro off the tank, and what should be an orderly killing spree will become a chaotic melee. This shouldn't be an issue. Jolene and Anya both know what they're doing, and Brad bought his character from us. His samurai has been carefully spec'd out to hit the sweet spot between too much damage and too little. The problem is the hammer. When Brad hired us 2 days ago, he asked if he could have access to his samurai in advance to get in some practice before the run. Since he was paying a quarter of our fee up front, I said yes. I guess I should have paid more attention to his comment about wanting to crack skulls. During practice, he decided he didn't like the katana his samurai was packing, so he went to the in-game auction house and bought himself a new weapon, Ivar's hammer. Ivar's hammer is basically Thor's hammer without the Marvel trademark issues. Even by the high production standards of Call to Wizardry, it is a gorgeously rendered virtual object, a brutal, sexy work of art with black basilisk leather handle wraps, a dragon tooth butt spike, and mithril filigree thunderbolts on the mallet head. You can see why an alpha male skullcracker would be drawn to it. Unfortunately, Ivar's hammer is a tanking weapon. Anything you hit with it gets really pissed off, and on critical hits shoots out fingers of lightning that aggro every other monster within 30 yards. Brad dies and Ray resurrects him. I warn Brad that this is going to keep happening if he insists on using the hammer. Brad doesn't want to hear it. As a paying customer, he feels he should be entitled to use any weapon he likes. I remind him that I'm only a guide to the game world. I don't make the rules. Figure something out, Brad says. We do what we can. I switch from Blockhead to the Warrior to Surveillance, a paladin who can call down holy fire and throw his shield like Captain America, and who is generally better at emergency crowd control. Jolene's Ranger summons a special companion animal, a fire-breathing tortoise that can serve as a secondary tank. When, despite my and Jolene's best efforts, Brad dies again, and again, Ray revives him, and Anya, whose druid moonlights as an armorsmith, patches the holes in his scale mail so we don't have to go back to town for repairs. Our contract with Brad guarantees him 2 full dungeon runs. Even the most difficult dungeons rarely take more than 3 or 4 hours to complete, and the caverns of malice where we are now ought to be a cakewalk, but the constant cycle of death and resurrection slows our progress to a crawl. An hour in, we've barely cleared the first boss. Brad is as frustrated as we are and not professionally constrained from showing it. As he gets more impatient, he starts charging into battle before the rest of us are ready, with predictable results. Jolene tries to calm Brad down, at which point we discover he doesn't particularly like black chicks, either. Jolene shuts up and Anya takes over. Her attempt to soothe Brad is more successful, but the dying continues. I crank up the jib setting on my user interface, causing Brad's demises to be rendered in as gory a fashion as possible, blood and viscera exploding from his wounds. This has no practical effect on gameplay, but it makes me feel better. After another 40 minutes, we reach the second boss, the green dragon Anastasia. We stop outside her lair so I can explain the fight to Brad. There are three phases, I tell him. In phase one, Anastasia will bite and claw. In phase two, she'll vomit a river of acid. In phase three, she'll beat her wings and conjure a storm of tornadoes. Then back to phase one and repeat, until either she or all of us are dead. The rules of survival are straightforward. Don't steal aggro off the tank. Don't stand in the acid. Avoid the tornadoes. We also need to be mindful of Anastasia's eggs, which are stacked along the walls of her cavern. The eggs are sensitive to jostling, and if bumped or struck by lightning, they'll hatch. Anastasia's brood spit acid like their mom. They also poop little patches of crazy glue that make it much harder to dodge tornadoes. Hatch more than a handful of eggs, and the fight quickly becomes unwinnable. Having laid all this out, I ask Brad if he would please, just for this one battle, switch back to his katana. No, Brad says. It's getting harder not to lose my temper with this guy, and not just because of the way he's behaving. Call to Wizardry's avatar creation system maps your real face onto the skull of whatever mythical creature you're playing. Brad's spray-tanned mug, stretched over the angular physiognomy of an elf, produces an unfortunate suggestion of yellow face that is amplified by the samurai costume. I feel like I'm talking to the lead from an old-fashioned production of The Mikado, who is an idiot. I'm a professional with bills to pay, so I keep my cool, but I also keep pressing. The hammer just isn't going to work in here, I say. It'll break too many eggs and we'll be stuck on this boss all night. Brad tells me that he can't switch back to the katana, okay? He doesn't have it anymore. He sold it to a vendor right before he bought Ivar's hammer. If I want to teleport back to town and buy him a new sword, fine, he'll use it for this one fight. Otherwise, I need to suck it up and deal. I really should buy him the replacement sword. It's the smart play. But I'm running out of patience and we've still got a long way to go, so I decide to brute force it instead. I look over at Jolene, who nods. Among the arrows in her quiver is a shaft of obliteration, the ranger equivalent of a tac nuke. The resources required to craft it cannot be purchased, but must be gathered, tediously, by hand. And generally its use is reserved for the deadliest end-level bosses. For Anastasia, it's complete overkill, but it should get us through the fight on the first try. Next, I B-channel Ray and slap a DNR order on Brad. No heals for him on this fight. Ray doesn't respond, but his expression tells me he'd already decided to cut Brad off. All right, I say, let's do this. Anastasia, curled in slumber at the center of her lair, blinks herself awake as we enter. I draw my sword and charge, but I don't rush to get to her first. When Brad cuts in front of me, yelling, "Banzai!" I let him take lead. He runs up and bops Anastasia on the nose. Wide awake now, she rears her head back, roaring. The quality of the animation is incredible. The mix of rage and confusion on the dragon's face perfectly mimics the expression of someone startled out of sleep by a band of homicidal midgets. Her eyes flit from Brad to me and back again, and she cocks her head, suggesting a new level of bafflement. Why is the DPS in front? Do these morons not understand how this works? Brad raises Ivar's hammer for another blow, and Anastasia swipes him with a claw, shredding his armor and tearing out his ribcage. As his heart and lungs exit stage right, she bends down and bites his head off. What's left of Brad's body collapses into a pile of quivering giblets. The cavern flares white as Jolene's nuclear arrow finds its mark. I move in, hurling my shield and hacking with my sword. "Battle, Resmi," Brad's disembodied voice cries. "Battle, Resmi." We ignore him. While I hold aggro, Anya, her druid now shapeshifted into a mountain lion, comes in from the side and rakes Anastasia with her claws. Jolene's pet tortoise hits the other flank, and Jolene, staying behind me, loses arrow after arrow. In no time, Anastasia is caught up in her own bloody death throes. We never even make it to phase three. As the dragon crashes to the ground, the vibrations from her fall cause all of her eggs to swell up and burst, harmlessly. For an instant, all is peaceful in the cavern. "Res me, you fucks," Brad shouts. Ray's already doing it. I'm sure he's tempted not to, but like me, he wants to get paid. Brad doesn't appreciate Ray's professionalism. His body reassembled, he leaps to his feet, shouting, "The fuck?" and darts at Ray with Ivar's hammer swinging. But the game won't let you attack your teammates, or shove them. When Brad tries to chest bump Ray, he passes right through him. "Brad," I say. I point to the treasure chest that's taken the place of Anastasia's corpse, its purple aura signifying epic loot. Still fuming, Brad stomps over to the chest and kicks it, which is allowed. The lid pops open, unleashing rays of gold-orange light. A trumpet flourish sounds. Not just epic loot, then. Legendary loot. Brad's won the lottery. I step up to get a better look, and my heart sinks as I see the sword hilt rising out of the chest. The Vorpal Blade of Gilliam, another tanking weapon. And not just any tanking weapon. For a paladin, the Vorpal Blade of Gilliam is the tanking weapon. It is as rare as it is powerful. You could open 1,000 loot chests and not find another. And like all legendary weapons, it's bind on pickup, so you'll never see one for sale in the auction house. Most Sherpa contracts specify that clients are only entitled to loot their characters can reasonably use. No tanking weapons for non-tanks, no DPS weapons for healers, etc. But clients of Sherpa Incorporated are entitled to any and all loot, without restriction. That way they never feel cheated by the rules, and if they choose to pass up loot voluntarily, they get to feel virtuous and altruistic. Brad's no altruist, but he stares for so long at the sword without taking it that I foolishly allow myself to hope he doesn't want it. Then he glances over at me. I've got my best poker face on, but Brad's Wall Street trader instincts see right through it. He grins and turns back to the chest. Brad ditches Ivar's hammer, which falls ringing to the floor and vanishes back into his inventory. His hand closes around the Vorpal Blade's hilt, and another trumpet flourish signals that it is now bound to him irrevocably. The sword blade is a length of razor-sharp crystal filled with changeable light. When Brad first holds it up, it's white with holy fire, but as he waves it back and forth, it turns brimstone red, noxious green, icy blue, and finally dark purple shot through with violet sparks. My despair deepens as I realize I'm never going to be able to hold aggro against this thing. And Brad was talking about going to Crimson Castle for his second dungeon run. Vampires and succubi, a crowd control nightmare. Chunk. The cavern suddenly brightens, as if Jolene set off another nuke. I turn and shield my eyes against the bank of Klieg lights that have appeared up near the ceiling. A second bank comes on beside them, and then a third. I'm reminded of my only visit to a real-world amusement park, on a field trip when I was 9. A friend and I snuck away from the group and went on the haunted house ride, which proceeded to break down, stranding us in the middle of a ghoul-infested graveyard. We screamed our heads off until the ride operator came to rescue us, emergency lights exposing the ghouls as nothing more than puppets on a stage. These Klieg lights have a similar effect, albeit one that is entirely computer-generated. In the blink of an eye, Anastasia's lair transforms from a photorealistic cave to a cheap set constructed of wood and papier-mâché. The 3D treasure chest becomes a painted flat propped up with a plank. "What the hell is going on?" says Brad, his legendary Vorpal Blade demoted to a styrofoam toy. "What's going on is we're about to get busted by the Eula police." I should be upset about this, and I am, but I can't help being impressed as well. Any other game company, having caught us violating their terms of service, would just dump us out of the system. But not Tempest. Even when they ban you, they turn it into a show. And it's this extraordinary level of polish that has made Call to Wizardry the most successful MMORPG in history. A section of the cavern wall swings open, revealing a concrete maintenance tunnel. 2 men in suits emerge. At first glance, they read as lawyers, but then you notice the gloves they are wearing, blue latex, like the kind police use when handling evidence. The gloves are an inside joke, a reference to a cult science fiction show that aired before I was born and was canceled after only 1 season. I'm a big enough nerd that I get it. The Eula cops aren't here to haul us off to virtual jail. They're executioners. Brad thinks he can fight them with his Nerf sword. He manages a few halting steps before the movement controls on his user interface stop working. Two by two, hands of blue, the Eulacops advance to the center of the room. We find ourselves drawn into a semicircle before them. Eulacop number one consults a computer tablet and addresses us one at a time, starting with me. John Chu, alias 8437 at gmail.com, a.k.a. Blockhead of Moria, a.k.a. Surveillance, you are guilty of violating Section 5 of the Call to Wizardry End-User License Agreement. Section 5 of the EULA prohibits unsanctioned commercial activities within the game world, i.e., it's the Anti-Sherpa Clause. Jolene, Anya, and Ray are all guilty of this offense as well, as is Brad for hiring us. Interestingly, Brad is also guilty of violating Section 2, which prohibits hacking into other players' accounts or profiting from said hacking. The penalty for these crimes is the immediate and permanent suspension of the offending user accounts, the EULA cop concludes. If you believe this judgment has been reached in error, you may appeal to customer service within 60 days. With that, he turns to his counterpart. EULA cop number 2 extends a gloved fist clutching a small cylindrical device. Translucent blue antennas sprout from both ends of it. They emit a harsh buzzing noise that jangles the nerves like fingernails scraping on a blackboard. I can't move, but from where I'm standing I can see Brad, at the far end of the semicircle. Blood starts drizzling from his samurai's nose and ears. The buzzing gets louder and the drizzle becomes a gusher. I experience a brief moment of satisfaction as Brad's head explodes. Then it's happening to me, too. Everything goes black. Words appear, floating in the void. Account terminated. Rest in peace, Blockhead of Moria. Rest in peace, Surveillance. I'm down to 88 names.
Okay, so thank y'all for coming. When I was writing this novel, which is, of course, set in virtual reality, I did not imagine that my first live reading from it would be in VR in the middle of a global pandemic, but here we are. And so before I get started, I just want to thank the people who made this possible, our sponsors, our host, Allspace VR, and our liaison, Drew. Blake Collier, who came up with the idea for the podcast campaign that this reading is part of. Our floating cameraman back there, Shahab. Our moderator, Skylar. And last but not least, Daryl Armstrong of the Threaded Zebra Agency, who's been working his tail off to make this happen under really difficult circumstances these last few weeks. So thanks to all of you guys. And one other thing, my internet connection is pretty stable, but if I disconnect in the middle of this, just hold on and I'll be back as quickly as possible. This novel had its origins in the early 2000s when I became interested in massive multiplayer online role-playing games. And when I say I was interested in them, I mean that I really, really wanted to play them. But fortunately for my productivity as a novelist, the dial-up connection I was using at the time wasn't fast enough to allow me to do that. So instead of playing them, I read about them. And it was through that reading that I learned about this phenomenon called gold farming, which is where people play online role-playing games and collect virtual loot, like gold pieces and rare magic artifacts, and then sell them to other players for real money. And this just kind of fascinated me on multiple levels, and I came up with the idea of telling a story about a gold farmer. And I thought it would be interesting to have the story take place entirely in virtual reality, so the characters would never see one another as they appeared in real life, but only as they chose to present themselves online. And in 2007, I pitched this as one of a trio of TV series ideas, the other two being The Mirage and Lovecraft Country. And the people I was talking to passed on all three notions. But I really liked these stories, and I decided to try turning them into novels, starting with The Mirage and then moving on to Lovecraft Country. And that worked out pretty well for me. As some of you may know, Lovecraft Country is being turned into an HBO series now. So it took a little longer than I expected, but I did finally get my TV series with that. And so when I finished Lovecraft Country, there was this question, you know, do I do the third one? Do I do 88 names? And I was a little on the fence at first because particularly after Lovecraft Country, I didn't want to do a novel that was just about video games. I think video games and game design are really interesting subjects, but I wanted the story to have more to it than that, and I wanted to make sure it would be accessible and interesting even to people with no background in gaming. And what ended up tipping the scales for me was that, you know, while I was working on those other novels, the internet and social media had become much more central to American culture. When I first started thinking about this story, Facebook was in its infancy and Twitter didn't even exist yet. But by the time I finished Lovecraft Country, tweets were driving entire news cycles. You know, the presidential candidates were tweeting and random individuals were destroying their lives with, you know, casual tweets. So I realized that, you know, what the novel could be about was not just video games, although it's certainly still about that, but just also about how living so much of our lives online was affecting the way we relate to each other and even the way we relate to ourselves. So I wrote the first three chapters and showed them to my wife, who is not a gamer, and she got very excited, much more than I was expecting her to. And she said, yeah, this is good. You should finish this. And then I showed it to my agent, who is definitely not a gamer, and she got very excited and said, yeah, this is good. You should finish this. So from there, I was just basically off to the races. And after a few more twists and turns, here I am in virtual reality in the middle of a global pandemic. So that's how it starts. And for my protagonist, John Chu, these raids by the Yula police are just part of the cost of doing business as a Sherpa. But there have been a lot of them lately, and he suspects that this is not an accident, but that his ex-girlfriend, Darla, may have something to do with them. So the Sherpa Incorporated business is in a bit of trouble. But then John Chu gets a new client who goes by the pseudonym of Mr. Jones. And Mr. Jones claims to be a wealthy, famous individual with powerful enemies. And he's offering $100,000 a week for a guided tour of the world of VR gaming. And this is one of those deals that's way too good to be true, but he's willing to pay in advance the first week, and the money is real, so John Chu takes the gig. But as it gets underway, he begins to suspect that Mr. Jones is actually the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. And the first two-thirds of the novel are set in virtual reality, in either game worlds or virtual chat rooms or other virtual spaces. And so everyone that John Chu is interacting with, pretty much, not just Mr. Jones, but his coworkers and even his ex-girlfriend Darla, are all people he's never actually met face-to-face. And because you have total control over how you look and sound in this reality, is basically this constant guessing game as to who's who and what they really want. And so that's the novel. It's this cat and mouse game between John Chu and Mr. Jones and Darla. And the final third of the novel, they do come out into reality and the masks come off and you get to see what's really going on. But so that's the basic idea anyway. And it was a blast to write. And so it is about video games, but it's also about identity and online life and all the weird things we do in this space. So that's the book. And with that, I think we should open things up to Q&A.
Yeah. At this point, if anybody has any questions, please raise your hand and we'll throw you the microphone.
Hi. My name's Ash. I'm up in the air thing over here.
Oh, hello.
Hi. I want to ask that. So this is all in a virtual reality world, like Ready Player One and another books.
Yeah. It's like Snow Crash, like Ready Player One, like Cyberspace and Neuromancer. Exactly. So imagine this kind of space, but 20 years in the future when it's all seamless and the controls are much more intuitive and, you know, it's photorealistic. So instead of looking like sort of cartoon figures, we actually look like real people moving around in a real space.
Cool. I actually just looked up your book and it looks very interesting. So
thank you.
I might look through it.
Anyone else have any questions?
As you said, in the beginning. Lovecraft Country is being made into a TV show right now. And yeah. It was one of the ones that you already pitched as a TV show in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
And 88 Names was one of those two.
Yeah, it was.
Yes.
These were a couple of producers. I believe it was Fox Studios, not the network, but the production studio. Mm-hmm. And they were fans of my fourth novel, Bad Monkeys. And basically they invited me to pitch original ideas for a TV series and, you know, encouraged me to let my imagination run wild and, you know, do whatever I wanted. And I kind of knew that when they were encouraging me to do whatever I wanted, that there were going to be definite limits on what you could get away with on American television, particularly at that time. But I decided to pretend that I really could do whatever I wanted and tried to come up with great ideas that would be make for fun TV, even if they couldn't necessarily get made. So my first pitch was for The Mirage, which was an alternate reality story set. Basically, it's a 9/11 story set in a reality where the Middle East and the U.S. have traded places. So 9/11 involves Christian fundamentalists flying planes into towers in downtown Baghdad and sort of takes off from there. And that was, that was way, way out of the box of what you could do, particularly when the war in terror was still going on, when the war in Iraq was still happening. Lovecraft Country was the second pitch, and that was, of course, you know, the X-Files, if Mulder and Scully were black travel writers living in the 1950s. And that was a little more doable, but it was a largely black cast. It was a period piece. It was going to be paranormal stuff, so it would probably have a pretty big special effects budget, and it was also going to be about racism. So again, it was kind of pushing the limits of what you could do in 2007. By the time I finished writing the novel in 2016, the cultural landscape had shifted quite a bit. And I finished, you know, Lovecraft Country was published right around the time that Jordan Peele was finishing Get Out, and he was looking around for his next project. And somebody, I don't know who, sent him my book, and he read it and liked it. And basically the success of Get Out allowed him very quickly to take the Lovecraft Country to HBO and sell them on the idea. So I my timing just happened to be really lucky for once. This was my third and final idea. And I think actually of the ones I pitched, this was the one that they showed the most interest in because it was probably closest to something you could do back in 2007, but even that one didn't go anywhere. So at that point, I just said, okay, I still kind of like these stories. Let me see what I can do with them and turn them into books. So it took longer than expected, really, but it has worked out. Well, thank you.
And what I was curious about that, because of the origin as TV pitches, the Lovecraft Country novel reads a lot like a TV series, which I think you said yourself, it's a lot like Monster of the Week stories each chapter. And when I read 88 Names, I came to the realization when they were visiting like different games. And I was wondering whether that was also like a holdover from the original pitch, that you were like, oh, in this episode, we can go into this kind of game. And in this episode, we can go in this kind of game. Or was that something that developed after the pitch?
Well, that was part of the concept that we could have used. It was I think in the case of 88 Names, it was less. It wasn't quite as strong as with Lovecraft Country, because part of what I wanted to do with Lovecraft Country was do the sort of X-Files Monster of the Week type thing and a larger arc story. And part of what I wanted to do was sort of take these traditional weird tale tropes or weird tale types of story and then see how they played if the protagonist was a black character who, you know, the kind of person who would not normally appear in a 1950s genre story. So, you know, there's one chapter in Lovecraft Country where a woman buys a house, gets an incredibly good deal on a house that turns out to be haunted. But in this case, it's a black woman buying property in a white neighborhood. So she's already got problems with that. And then the ghost is white too, and he doesn't want her there any more than the neighbors do. So she's fighting enemies within and without to try to keep the property. And so things like that, like taking these sort of classic story tropes and plugging in black characters and seeing how that changed things. And
That was something I very much wanted to keep for the novel, so I had to come up with a sort of episodic structure. With 88 Names, it was more part of it. I just wanted to show the variety of the landscape of what's available in VR. And yeah, but certainly if you were going to do this as a TV series, you would have, yes, this week we're going to go, you know, we're going to spend the entire week just fishing in, you know, World of Warcraft or whatever. And then, you know, oh, this week we're going to do this. But I was less locked into sort of episodic and more like, I want to take a guided tour of what VR can do. So that was the
cool
idea.
Thanks. I was wondering, if your research in this book, was it, would you say virtual reality, like, did you already have experience with it, or did you end up, like, you heard about it and dipped your toes in it, and then it allowed you to have this idea for the book? Like, how exactly did virtual reality in your life personally evolve with the formation of this book?
I mean, what I think partly I have more of a grounding just spending way too much time online and on the internet and playing a lot of games. So I experience VR in the sense that I know what it's like to play a really immersive game. Like, you know, like I did ultimately end up playing a lot of online role-playing games. What I didn't have a lot of experience with was the full bore 3D, you know, super immersive VR where you're wearing goggles. But I didn't so much worry about that because, again, I wanted to write not about VR as it currently exists in this sort of emerging technology phase. I wanted to write about it as it is going to be in about 20 years or so, 10 or 20 years, when the technology matures and it's just, you know, the goggles are much, you know, more comfortable to wear and the user interface is more intuitive. So I was sort of like writing about the platonic ideal of VR. And in a way, I even if I'd had the money to buy the goggles before I wrote the novel, I'm not sure I would have, because I wouldn't have gotten bogged down in the current limitations of the technology. But it was interesting when I was done, in part because of the Lovecraft Country sale, I was able to finally reward myself with an Oculus Rift headset and sort of go in and compare my vision of what it was like to what it's actually like. And I feel like it's pretty close in a lot of ways. There's the things that are mainly different are just there are certain aspects of the way the user interface currently works that are different than what I was thinking about in the novel. But it's the parts that matter are close enough. So that was what it was. But it was my research, quote unquote, was just more lots and lots of time playing interactive games and lots of time on Twitter and other parts of the internet, and just seeing how people behave when they can pass themselves off as other people or when they have this shield of anonymity or a pseudonymity.
Next up is Larry.
Hey, Larry.
Am I?
I can hear you. Now? Yep.
Fantastic. Hey, Matt.
Larry and I are real world friends.
If we were in real bodies. You know, I'm wondering, Matt, you know, you've spent a lot of time now playing video games. Right now we're using VR and interacting there. And of course you've written a story now that's set largely in the world of VR. What do you think about that? What do you think about VR as a, are you interested in it as a storytelling mechanism itself?
I am. I think and I mean, it's been doing the podcast and talking to some of the tech people involved in this has been really eye-opening too. I think that even more than playing around with the technology myself, just seeing what other people are thinking about doing with it has been really cool. The main issue, and we discussed this with one of the people we talked to, is that I feel like the bar for getting into it is still very high. I mean, one of the great things about novels is that you can just go off and you can just go off and do it yourself. You don't even need a computer for that. You can just start writing. Whereas the problem with VR, I think from a creative standpoint, at least from my perspective, is the same one with computer games. Like, I'm old enough to remember when a single individual could write a cutting edge computer game, you know, back in the very brief period when home PCs had, you know, literally like maybe you know, the memory was measured in kilobytes, so you really could sit down and write a cutting edge game. And as soon as the graphics engines got off the ground and the sound got off the ground, it became more like filmmaking, where you can still do it with a small group of people, but the number of things you need to know to do it well is gone up, so it raises the bar. And I feel the same way that it seems to me that VR is also going to be pretty much a team sport, and at least for now, you really do require a fair amount of equipment and software to do something really cool. But my hope is that as it matures, one of the things that will come out of that is tools to make it much easier to play with and to do really neat original things with. Whether I'll still be around at that point, I don't know. Yeah, so I would like to be able to play with it, but it, you know, I would probably at this point have to team up with a bunch of people who've become fully immersed in it and know what they're doing, and I would just provide ideas and watch them execute them, you know.
Makes sense.
But I think that the potential of it is amazing. I mean, I've seen some really cool stuff and it's just getting started, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, hopefully we can, I mean, YouTube and the tool sets that people can use now have made it easy. You can make your own film and TV. And so hopefully in a few years, we can do the same with VR.
Yeah, I hope so. That'd be great.
Next up, Suzanne.
Hi there.
Hello.
The question I was going to ask has been pretty much covered. That was along the same themes. I've never been to a book reading before, and virtual reality has been a new experience for me. And reading, like you reading your book, has been really interesting and really intriguing. And I guess then leading on from like Larry's question, when you were writing this story and you had your vision of what VR is going to be like in the future and that utopia that you were talking about, and then getting your test and trying it out for the first time yourself, was there any sort of what would your learnings be from that? What was your experience? What were the highs and lows when you made that sort of blend into that world that you were creating?
I think that the two biggest things that one that I just didn't really think about that much in the novel, because it is the problem of moving around. That the office where my computer lives and where I do VR, it's a long and narrow space, and so there's a limit. Even if I weren't tethered to the machine, there are just very clear limits on how far I can move in any given direction. And even more important than that, if I'm not facing the long direction of the office, I have to be very careful about how I move my hands, because even with the Oculus Guardian system that warns you when you're moving out of your designated space, if you're punching or flailing your arms, you can blow right past that before your brain has time to see the warning. So I've cracked my knuckles a couple times on my bookshelves, and that sort of limits the things I can do. And I had just not given a lot of thought to that in writing the novel. People are going to be playing these games, and you are going to be playing, at least some people are going to be in studio apartments. So the question of when you describe the characters as walking around, what are they actually doing? And it doesn't really matter in terms of this novel, but it is something that's interesting to think about, that this problem of movement. And this leads to the second issue, which is motion sickness, which I naively assumed, because I have played a lot of first-person shooters and flight simulators, and I have never had a problem with nausea playing computer games, that, oh, I'm sure some people get nausea, you know, messing around in VR, but I won't. But it turns out that, yeah, having the screen strapped to your face is a whole different thing, at least for me, than having it, you know, 2 feet in front of me. And I don't know if it's the lack of a fixed reference that I have when I'm looking at a normal computer screen or what, but I find that in actual VR, I get very queasy very quickly. If my avatar is moving and my body knows that it isn't, I start to get really uncomfortable. So gliding and flying are very difficult for me. Teleporting I'm fine with, instantaneous transitions, and actually walking around or moving within the space, the extent that I can do it, that's fine. But It's unfortunate because it does lock out some of the more fun things. Like, I'd love to be able to fly and go zooming around, you know, skyscrapers and stuff. But if I did, I'd probably be losing my lunch. So I'm hoping that there is a fix for this, and maybe it's just getting used to it. I don't know. But that was something else. I joke about this in the novel, but I just didn't really realize until I had messed with it what a limitation it can be. And actually, my very first experience, I think, with a headset was I went to, there's a place near our house called Portal that rents time on the HTC Vive. And there I went on a warm day. I purposely did not drink a lot beforehand because I didn't want to, you know, I was paying for an hour and I didn't want to take my headset off and go to the bathroom while I was playing. And I didn't eat too much either. So I'm on a somewhat empty stomach. It's a hot day. It's a hot space. And the first game I played was this ninja thing where you're jumping around. And I started hyperventilating the way you do right before you projectile vomit. And I was like, man, I may not be able to continue this. I'm going to be, and I was really mad because I paid for an hour. So, but fortunately I was able to switch to stuff that was not like, not leaping and jumping, but that was quite an eye-opening experience. So that was the biggest thing. And obviously the technologically, there's no reason why you couldn't have, for example, an actual large space to walk around in and track yourself. It's just that people are not going to be able, most people cannot afford to dedicate whole gymnasiums to virtual reality setups. So yeah, so it's going to be interesting to see how much of a limitation that's going to be. So those are my two biggest things. But the other stuff, I'm really pleased with how far it's come forward. And I'm also intrigued by the novel things that people are able to do with it. Like when you first start playing, you quickly realize there's a couple standard genres of game that everybody has tried their hand at, but then you come across things that are a bit more clever. Brandon Oldenburg, one of the people we talked to, we interviewed for the podcast, he did a sort of an interactive story. I forget what it's called off the top of my head, but where you are riding on this train and you're taking the place of various different animals. And it's not so much a game as an interactive story that as it goes along, you are following three different characters through this space. And it's just like, it was a really cool and creative thing to do with the technology. And so seeing that in particular gave me hope that once tech gets easier to use and once more people can make use of it, they're going to be doing really amazing things with it that I haven't even, it wouldn't even occur to me to try and do, which is great. So sorry, that's a bit of a rambling answer, but yeah, it is a really fascinating technology. And one of the nice things about having written the book is that I'm getting invited to play with it in cool ways. So that's nice.
Up next is Ash again, I think.
So I kind of just remembered that I read your book, Bad Monkeys, in eighth grade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's actually really fun and I enjoyed it a lot. And I wanted to say that I'm now fangirling after remembering that, so.
Oh, well, thank you.
Hi. Jamie, thank you.
All right, up next is Adric.
There you go. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yep, got you 5x5.
All right. So just hearing the different answers and, you know, hearing your how amazing your book sounds and your novel sounds, it started making me think while I was sitting here. So my question would be, given how VR is and where it's going in different spots and places, could you or would you like to see your novel 88 Names become a fully interactive experience world with the characters in them where users and readers can go and be the character in the story and have a world that's virtually drawn and written in the same as the story? So not only are you reading your novel, but you're actually experiencing it in virtual reality in first person.
I don't know if that would, it's an interesting idea, but I think that if I were going to try and tell a story in VR, I would probably come at it differently. Because again, it really, the VR experience is really more in some ways like film, I think, and that's a much more visual medium. So At the very least, you'd have to translate it. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, you could probably do something with that, but I think I would probably want to come up with something totally original. And part of the problem is that, of course, in 88 Names, like the games that they are playing are for the most part inspired, like they're sort of futuristic 3D versions of games that already exist. So Call to Wizardry is pretty obviously inspired by World of Warcraft, and you know, there's a space game called the Fermi Paradox, which is pretty clearly inspired by EVE Online, and then there's a sort of Grand Theft Auto, but much more violent and larger version of Grand Theft Auto called Habitual Offender.
Again, he lost connection. He'll be back shortly. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm back. Sorry about that. It just faded out for a second. In a way, the coolest parts of the novel kind of already exist at the limits of the current technology. I don't know. I'd have to think about it. But I think what I would really love to do is just do my, if I were going to do that, is come up with my own, like, unique new MMO or something like that. And try to come up with something original, but rather than map this novel over. But who knows? I mean, I may have somebody may come up with an idea of how to adapt it that would appeal to me. It's possible.
All right, perfect. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure.
And next up, a quick question from me. Which headset do you have, and have you played Beat Saber before?
Yeah, I've got the Oculus Rift S, yes, I have played Beat Saber. That is one of those games that I have to be careful to be facing in the right direction, and I cannot, you know, especially if I'm dodging side to side, I have to be really careful about waving my arms too far one way or the other, because I will start smacking bookshelves or my computer monitor. So I don't know, if I make a little more money, maybe I will get myself the Oculus Quest as well, so I can go down to the garage where there's a little more room to move around in. One of the reasons I picked the Rift, though, is for the same reason I have a PC rather than a Mac, I always want access to more games rather than, you know, cooler looking technology. And so I just figured I'd get the one that has a more powerful processor and slightly better resolution and a lot more games to choose from. Although, as I discovered, my actual options are limited by practicalities, like the size of the room and the fact that I get sick if I play the wrong thing. But I might at some point double up and just get a Quest, or wait for the next generation to come out, where the thing is a little, I'm hoping the goggles will start to get lighter. The other thing I'm thinking too is having, you know, I've got friends who've got access to the early Magic Leap. Once that becomes more readily available, maybe augmented reality is what I want to play with, where maybe that will solve the nausea problem. If I can see the real world happening in the background and my eyes and my sense of proprioception will be matched rather than fighting with one another.
Next up is Shadow.
What was your inspiration for this book?
This started out, yeah, this was basically, I was reading about this phenomenon of gold farming, of people, you know, as soon as massive multiplayer online role-playing games debuted, there were people who realized that you could play the games and collect, you know, virtual gold and, you know, really rare, you know, magic items and stuff like that, stuff that took time to get, and then you could sell them to other players who had more money than time. And there was this, you know, big trade going on where people would sometimes, for rare items, they would pay hundreds or sometimes even over $1,000 for stuff. And that was really interesting to me on a number of different levels. First of all, this was before PayPal, right? So people were mailing cashier's checks to strangers and then, you know, arranging to meet in the game world in such and such a time. And it was amazing that they would trust people to do that. And it often enough would work. And part of it wasn't just that people were making money doing this, but then it created this real dilemma for the game companies, because first of all, some of them just objected that people were making money off their IP without permission. But then it also created these customer service issues where if somebody did get burned on the deal, they would call up the company and complain. The company would have to explain, well, you know, we're sorry you didn't get your magic sword, but these guys don't work for us, so we can't help you. And then there were other players who'd get upset because they felt, perhaps not unreasonably, that this was cheating, that, you know, people were able to buy advancement in the game that other people had to work for. And yet another issue is that when you create a monetary incentive for playing a game, it brings in a whole host of people who play the game in a different way than people who are just there to have fun. And so you would have people behaving really obnoxiously and trying to monopolize resources. You know, if there's one monster that drops a particularly valuable item, then people who want to sell that item are going to try and sit on that thing and kill it every time. And then if you want to kill it for a quest, that creates problems. And there were also, like in the early games, you were allowed to attack and kill people pretty much any time. And in some games, they allowed you even to loot the corpses after you killed people, you know, as we do in real life. And again, if the gold has real value, then you create an incentive for players not just to troll people for the sake of griefing them, but because they can make money by picking on weaker players and taking their stuff. So that just brought up all these really interesting issues of not just, you know, not just a cool story about business, but also about the difficulty of making and enforcing rules, even in a computer space where you think that the programmers have godlike powers. And it turns out it's really hard to make rules that allow people to do what you want them to do, but don't restrict, you know, it's just a really tough thing. So that's just a fun thing to work with. So I wanted to tell a story about someone who was a gold farmer, or as I eventually evolved this into the idea of a Sherpa, somebody who will cater adventures for you, but then also talk about just these problems of interacting with people online and the difficulty of enforcing good behavior. And it just leads into a whole bunch of really interesting issues that you could play with. So that was how I got started, and thought about it for a really long time before I got to work on it. So I came up with a lot of little bits of business I could use. So that was the inspiration.
Okay, and one final one from Blurt, and then I'm closing hand raises.
Hi, I just wanted to, wait one second.
Yep.
I just wanted to assure you that you can get past the motion sickness. I mean, it might not ever go away, but a lot of the games have settings that you can kind of fiddle with to protect you that way. And you learn sort of your limitations, and then also, you know, you can sit down when you're starting them. Like if it's one where you're in a boat and it's zooming along and that's something I would get nauseous, I learned that if I'm not standing, that helps a lot. So just kind of those two things, you definitely do get used to it if you do it in little small doses and kind of try to protect yourself with the settings. Don't give up.
I may be being too much of a boy about this because I was really annoyed with myself because I'm like, wait a minute, this is not supposed to be a problem for me. I've never had this problem with normal computer games, but yeah, so I'm hoping that's the case. And I certainly want to, keep trying with it because otherwise it's going to be, I'm just going to have to get one of them really cool rigs that lets you like literally bounce into the air while you're flying. So that, you know, one of the Ready Player One things with an omnidirectional treadmill and suspend myself from the ceiling, but that's getting really ambitious. So hopefully there's an easier solution.
You can do it. Well, and I think when you have a headset that isn't tethered, that will also help.
Definitely.
Kind of give you a little bit more ways to turn and,
I think with another generation or two of technology too, this a lot of this stuff is going to smooth out, and that's part of it as well. I don't know how much of it is just the resolution of the thing I'm using. I mean, I actually went to the trouble of, because I do wear glasses, I went to the trouble of ordering custom lenses that I could insert so I don't have to wear my glasses while I'm playing, and that's been quite a help. It makes it much less difficult, and it makes it easier to put the headset on and get going, which was one other thing about the experience, that with regular computer games, I can usually jump into most of them within just a, you know, like half a minute, whereas with VR, it's more of a production to get the headset out and plug it in and get it on and boot up the software. That takes long enough that it's not quite of an impulse, an easy impulse to do it. And I think once we, again, once it gets more intuitive and quicker to boot up, I think that will help a lot as well. But yeah, anyway,
that'll help in the quest. Sure. There was one other thing I was going to say with that. I just lost my train of thought. Well, thank you so much for doing this. This has been great.
Thank you guys so much for coming. And this has been a lot of fun. And you can visit my website at www.bymattruff.com. That's a B-Y as in a byline. And we've got links to the podcast from there and stuff about my other novels and so forth. So I hope you'll come by. But thank you very much for coming to this and for being such a great audience. This was fun. And thanks again to you guys, my hosts, and Daryl especially, man. You've been great. And Skylar, thank you for coming to do this. And Floating Shahab, and you, Blake. God, you guys are all great. So this is fun.
I also want to quickly shout someone out also. I'm going to shout out Adric real quick for messaging me when he got in here to say that he's available to moderate if we need it. And I gave him moderator permission because I trust him. And yeah, he's just been there on the sidelines helping us out.
Thank you, everybody. Matt and Skylar said it all. So thanks, everyone, for coming. Hope you all have a good evening. Stay safe. Wash your hands. Stay healthy.
GC Records proudly sponsors this podcast. To stream or download over 20 years of music, head to gcrecords.bandcamp.com.
That is it for this episode of 88 Names Podcast. If you like the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and a review, which will help us get more listeners. Remember to check back at the podcast site at riseupdaily.com/88namespodcast for the podcast introduction and upcoming written interviews and articles. We would like to thank Threaded Zebra Agency, Altspace VR, Drooted, and Creative Mornings for their support and work on this podcast. We will see you soon.